if you walk inside a Starbucks, right, you can have free Wi-Fi and free electricity actually too. I think that over the next 20, 30 years, whether it's SMRs or renewable penetration, big nukes getting bigger, I think we're going to see energy prices really go very close to zero. And I think electric vehicles and the home, we have a much more sophisticated world.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Fundrise. Fundrise provides access to diversified portfolios of private real estate to all investors with their industry-leading, easy-to-use platform. Sign up today at fundrise.com/twist. OpenPhone. Create business phone numbers for you and your team that work through an app on your smartphone or desktop. Twist listeners can get an extra 20% off any plan for your first 6 months at openphone.com/twist. And Linear. Linear helps product teams focus on what they do best, planning and building great products. Streamline issues, projects, and product roadmaps in a tool your team will actually enjoy using. Get 25% off at linear.app/twist.
All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. I'm your host, Jason Calacanis. With me, my co-host, Alex Wilhelm, and we have a full docket. How are you, Alex?
I am good. I was typing up until the very last minute to get all the notes in. We have a surprise guest. Lots Love to get it. To, Jason. But first, I want to show you my new favorite robotic demo because I think everyone deserves a laugh this week. So, generative AI, great at text generation, understanding written words. But what about your face, Jason? Well, it turns out that some folks over at Columbia University have made a robot that can do a couple things. One is it can mimic you very directly and very quickly. Two words here, uncanny valley. How does that make you feel to start?
I think it's great. It's awesome. It looks like the movie I, Robot. Right, which was Asimov. It's clearly somebody in that lab. Where is this taking place? China or NYU or MIT?
This is the Creative Machines Lab at Columbia University.
Oh, okay. Well, I was triangulating from MIT up to MIT.
In between.
We wound up on 125th Street. Congratulations to the team there. That looks awesome. And I do think it's close to hitting the uncanny valley. And if I went to a McDonald's and interfaced with this person or interfaced with this at a Starbucks or at a counter at United Airlines or whatever, Southwest, I would have no problem with that. I think it'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. It has 26 actuators to actually make the face. And here's the coolest part, Jason. As of later this year, Emo, this robot, has, quote, learned to predict a forthcoming smile about 840 milliseconds before the person actually smiles. So robots can now anticipate your facial movements, which means that I think our future of using humans for human-facing interactions are coming to an end. So everyone, please welcome your robot overlords. Welcome to the future.
I mean, I think one of the things we're going to contend with, and I'm not trying to be too humorous here, is we have population declines. Young people maybe are not seeing the value in starting families. Maybe marriage feels a little weird to folks. We might be the last generation that felt that was like what you're supposed to do. It's kind of like the default. You get married, you make babies. You go to college, make babies, get a career going. So I think if you look at young people today, maybe opting out of careers, they're not as career focused. They're work-life balance focused. Everybody, you know, I interview, I would say 2 out of 3 young people are like, hey, tell me about life-work balance. I'm like, that doesn't exist at my company, but if you want it at yours, please, by all means, start a company and compete against us. Number two, they don't seem to be on the marriage track. Number three, they do not seem to be on the owning a home or having kids track. And now, of course, there's all kinds of reasons for that. Financial, owning a home is hard in this country, unless you're in Texas. Side note there, we'll get into real estate another show. But I think it's interesting about this, Alex, is, and again, this isn't to make light of the situation in any way, but companionship is complex. You're in a relationship with another human being for an extended period of time. It's dynamic. People evolve and you have to work at a relationship. You don't have to work at a relationship with a large language model. It'll just do what you want it to do. It'll be what you want it to be. And then you add to it this face. And if this face starts talking to you and you get more warmth and care, empathy from the LLM, which the LLM, if we're going to sit here and say LLMs, like we said on yesterday's show, can do surgery as good as the best, most perfect surgeon, Waymo, wants to make the best driver in the world and Joby wants to make the best pilot in the world, the singular. Mm. Well, I think Columbia with that face and the LLMs and a bunch of other projects we've seen are going to make the perfect companion. And then that'll make all of us highly unpredictable, you know, variable humans. Maybe for young people, they'll just want the comfort of the perfect companion.
Yeah, maybe. The good news for you and I, though, is that no one's going to let robots play poker with us at the table. So if we're going to do our favorite form of gambling, we're going to still need friends. And that is bullish for human interaction.
No droids. We don't like your kind here. Welcome to Mos Eisley. Get the hell out, C-3PO.
I mean, quite literally, if C-3PO sits down, I'm done because I can't do math better than a computer. All right, let's put that aside. On the show today, my friends, we have the rise of global solar with a very special guest that you may recall from the Liquidity Summit earlier this year. Then a media deal we didn't see coming that involves someone named Alex Jones. We'll get into that. The latest on the polymarket mess.
Well, global, you know, industrious complex. Startup industrial complex. Jason Galgett has invested in far too many companies. Y Combinator, it's a global industrial complex.
Jason's here to sell you some supplements, by the way, in case you were curious, and to talk about the sexuality of frogs. The mess of Polymarket, and then we're going to wrap up this week in startups with a note on Y Combinator's request for starts.
Venture capital is one of the most lucrative asset classes in the world. Why? Look at today's public companies. Nearly all of them raised capital when they were private. Don't I know it? Uber and Robinhood are the number one and the number two hits. I invested in both of those, as you know, when they were private companies and before they even launched their products. And for venture capitalists and their backers, this is great, right? It's great to be me. Trust me, I love my job. But what if you don't have enough capital to back a venture fund or start one? And I'll tell you something, it's really hard to get into the top quartile funds. You know, you have to know somebody who knows somebody, and you have to write a giant check, and you know, you might be able to get into it a couple of years from now. How do you get in on some of these deals that institutional investors like endowments or sovereign wealth funds or high net worth individuals are doing? Well, if you don't know a guy who knows a guy who knows a gal, you aren't going to be able to buy shares in, say, that next hot AI startup until it goes public. But now there's another option, the Fundrise Innovation Fund. This is a $125 million fund. That's like a medium-sized venture capital fund that holds shares in some of the most exciting pre-IPO tech companies in the world. It's specifically designed for individual investors. So now you can get in early at fundrise.com/twist. That's fundrise.com/twist. Carefully consider the investment material before investing, including objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. This and other information can be found in the Innovator Fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/innovation. This is a paid advertisement.
Jason, why don't you introduce our guest and then I'll talk about what we're talking about.
All right. My good friend, Phil Deutsch, has educated me tremendously over the last two decades on how energy works. And when an energy story happens, the first thing I do is just, I try to level set and understand the dynamics. Because when you're just reading the press, you know, you assume what you're reading is pretty straightforward. You read maybe a government press release like we did this morning. And today I wanted to talk about headline that keeps coming up, which is one of my favorite countries, Australia. And Australia has been having these moments where the overwhelming majority of their electrical, of their electricity is coming from solar. And then in India, my understanding is a lot of people are hacking together their own solar panels, really crummy batteries, and going off grid. And then I'm here in Texas and having a lot of conversations with friends. I just actually was talking to Bill Gurley and we were talking about solar at our ranches. And you could actually, if you have enough space, you got an extra couple of acres, you could actually build your own solar farm and then give back to the grid. Anyway, all of this is fascinating to me and I think very world positive. Welcome back to the program, Phil Deutsch.
Thanks, Jay Cal. Great to be here.
Alex, why don't you tee up just some facts on what's happening in Australia? Because we've been trying to get to this story for 2 or 3 weeks, but there was some other stuff going on in the country and it keeps getting pushed back. But
yeah,
big picture, there's something like 4 million homes in Australia have now have residential solar panels on their roof. And on a penetration basis, I think there's 30 or 40 million people there. I'm not sure how many households, but it's a large number of households. Walk us through the numbers.
All right. So back in 2011, Australian rooftop solar was kind of expected to eventually reach 4 terawatts of generation in Australia. That was going to be about 2% of total generation, according to the reports that I found. A decade later, it was actually 6x that eventual target. So the growth in Australian solar production has been absolutely crazy. And I think last year, rooftop solar panels that are part of the national electricity market were worth 24.6 terawatts. That's an enormous amount of generation, tons of power. And that works out to just about, I think, 12% of homes generating electricity, and that's 3.7 million households. And then most recently, Elon Musk actually highlighted a data point from Western Australia that caught our attention, Jason. And it was that on one day this week at 1:30 p.m., and time does matter for solar stories, distributed solar PV accounted for 2.12 gigawatts of output, which was, I think, about 81% of total generation, far outstripping what was generated from both natural gas and coal. So for a bit of time, Western Australia was essentially one large solar panel, Jason.
And we've had the same thing, Phil, in Germany, where Germany had renewables as a cluster tip over to the majority. And then in Texas, I think we have the largest install base of solar here in Texas. Quite paradoxical, I guess, in some ways. I guess my first question to you, Phil, is what's your take on what's happening in Australia? Is it a monoculture with, you know, a very supportive government, everything aligned in terms of subsidies, and they're just going for it? Does it have to do with geography and solar just working really well because they have a lot of space? It's a large, large landmass, and they're close to China. Maybe they get cheap solar panels pretty easy. Explain to me what the theory is here. What can we learn about Australia, and is it in any way a roadmap for the rest of the West or even India and China?
Yeah, first of all, it absolutely is. And let's break it down two things. First of all, when you install solar or wind, most of your cost is all up front. It's a fixed capital cost. Sun doesn't cost you anything. The wind doesn't cost you anything. So you produce no matter what. And so the more you install it, you're going to have these things when the wind blows or the sun shines where you're going to have a lot of production. So the United States, both in California and Texas, we've already had moments where electricity prices have gone negative because the turbines get a production tax credit, so they want to sell up until negative 1 cent. So just the sheer amount of renewable power in any jurisdiction can cause these weird abnormalities where you get negative prices when they get to be a huge part of the supply. That occurs today. And that's going to occur more and more in the world the more renewable penetration we have. The second thing is this residential solar, where you put the panels on the houses, which is what you're quoting Australia. So if you give me 1 second here, it's kind of an interesting problem. You decide to put panels on your house. And let's say the panel, the electricity costs you, just for argument's sake, 20 cents per kilowatt hour. In Palo Alto, where you used to live, where I live, electricity probably costs us 40 cents a kilowatt hour. So you say, great, that's a win for me. I'm going to put my panels up. Now, the problem is your panels don't provide electricity at night, or maybe when you have the cold plunge going and the washing machine and the home theater. But at that point, you rely on the grid. Well, your local utility says, of the 50 cents I was charging you, the 40 cents for your kilowatt hour at home, 2/3 of that was for me to have the grid ready for you. So if I let everyone just switch to home solar without picking up any part of the grid, I'm going to destroy my business model. And so there are places in the world where the utilities are going under because people are getting out of the grid and they have to think about that. They're called stranded costs. Like, how do I pay back all these wires and infrastructure? So when you have this residential solar, the ultimate question is, how much does a homeowner have to pay for the grid that is using less of? So that's the real question. If you talk to someone who likes residential solar, they say, screw you, it's my house, I can do what I want on it, I should have to pay you a penny. And if you talk to the utility, they say, you should be paying me a lot of money per kilowatt hour. So in Australia, they have very good rate, they have very good rebates and tariffs that encourage solar. We used to have that in California, and the utilities recently amended that in something called NEM 3.0. And when we put down the rebates and the government support, there was a slow in residential solar.
Actually, Phil, I had that chart for us. Let's pull that up, John, if we could. Just explain this chart for folks who are watching the YouTube video. The bars that are blue are the old regime in California regarding how much you could get paid for having rooftop solar. And then the yellow bars mark the new regime, NEM 3.0, or what's called NBT in government lingo. But Jason, what matters here is after this change was announced, there was an explosion in people putting solar out because they could get the earlier rate. And since the rules have changed, we've seen a decline. And if you observe the size of the orange, the yellow bars, I mean, compared to historical blue bars, you can see a decrease in install. So Phil, it seems that NEM 3.0 really smashed the install rate of rooftop solar in California.
Yeah, exactly. And basically just a question of how much of the savings is the homeowner getting? And NEM 3 took away some from the homeowner, really. But what I think is like the most interesting thing is when you think about a house that could have an electric vehicle with it, a power wall, and residential solar, that's really the wave of the future. You really love to have all that stuff on site. The question, though, really is how expensive is that? The EV and the Powerwall probably pay for themselves because you're comparing yourself to gasoline. I think the question of residential solar on site is a harder question because just think about it this way. If I were to take a couple acres of Jason's Ponderosa, I could lay down fields and fields of solar. Whereas if I did it with my little small trailer park home in Atherton, someone's going to get up, put nails in the roof, and do a whole bunch of fixed costs. So it's much easier to do solar at scale.
That is like a very interesting concept. When I started talking about solar recently, I immediately started the discussion with the roof of our house, and they were like, "Roof, just find an acre in the quarter of the ranch, and you put the batteries there, you put the solar panels." And I was actually talking to Freeberg about it, and he said, one of the incredible gains that you get from having space is that power walls and other units that are meant to be inside the house are designed to be incredibly small in terms of footprint for obvious reasons. You don't want to give up a bunch of square footage to it. But doing that doubles the cost of them and makes them much more expensive than if you just put them into, I don't know, a container, a small shed.
A shed,
You just spread them out, and those are much cheaper. I guess the long and short of this is, if you were running the United States and we started looking, you know, 10, 20, 30 years out, we know that we're going to have a massive demand for all these data centers. We know that we are an energy exporter. We have tons of natural gas. We've got tons of oil. We're doing pretty great all of a sudden after all this fear and hand-wringing. So it's a two-part question. Number one, why did we have so much fear and hand-wringing for so long in this country and in the world writ large about peak oil, and that the entire world was going to be thrown into chaos at the, you know, 10 years after the millennium, and that the United States was going to have to fight all these foreign wars and bring the oil back? And now we're sitting here and everybody got everything wrong. And then we'll go to part two, which is, okay, if we got everything wrong over the last 30 or 40 years, our lifetime has been filled with fear, uncertainty, and doubt about energy, and we solved it all. How do you think about the next 30 or 40 years of our lives?
Yeah, well, I think in the first part, you're absolutely right. We got it wrong, and we continue to get it wrong. Every estimate for solar is always too low. And you see it with EVs, Jason. People just don't understand how fast a J-curve works when you're in it. So I think the good news is technology wins. It just wins. It doesn't matter who's in office, what interest rates are, technology wins, and it has in energy, be it fracking or solar panels. And so what do I think of the next 30 years, let's say? If I say 30 years, I won't be around for it when I'm wrong. So I'd like to use 30 years. I think electricity is basically free. So we don't think of it as a cost, which is like Wi-Fi. Remember in the beginning of Wi-Fi, how much it, or just the
Boingo, broadband. Shout out to Sky Dayton. We had to give $30 a month. And I think a Go-Go in-flight was probably $30 or $40, and you could get a membership for $50 and share it at your company.
Sky still makes me send him checks for some reason, but he now doesn't be a poker game. But yes. So, but now, if you walk inside a Starbucks, right, you can have free Wi-Fi and free electricity, actually, too. I think that over the next 20, 30 years, whether it's SMRs or renewable penetration, big nukes getting bigger, I think we're going to see energy prices really go very close to zero. That after you've amortized the upfront costs, and you'll see a lot of carbon-free sources. So I'm very, very bullish on that. And I think electric vehicles and the home, we have a much more sophisticated world. I mean, you're the expert on this, but I think it's highly unlikely that my grandchildren drive their own car. It'll be autonomous electric. I think Elon is seems very compelling to that to me. Going to Waymo, it's hard to imagine going back in some ways. And so I see a world with a lot of energy choice and technology just continues to surprise us on the upside. I'm very bullish.
It's interesting you bring that up. I had a dream the other night that I was in my self-driving car on the way to a dinner in Texas. And I was watching, because I had just fallen asleep watching the Knicks game. Shout out Jungle Cat. And I had this dream, and in the car, the entire Knicks game was on the windshield.
Yeah.
With all the statistics and everything was on the display panel. So instead of speed and everything, I was just looking at the player stats and the shooting percentage and everything. And I woke up in the morning and I was just super delighted to think, God, we're going to recapture a lot of all that productivity and time and distance is going to shrink 100%. In many ways. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about a 2-hour car ride, you'd be able to see a movie. As you say, as though you're at the game, maybe it'll be in a workout in a car. I don't know. Maybe like the Flintstones, we pedal while we're going.
When you look at the, I call it the skiff. It's kind of like the Jabba the Hutt skiff that he takes to the Sarlacc that Elon made. The sort of bus, I don't know what he called it, Cybervan. Or, what was the name?
A skiff, as you may know, is a secured facility in the intelligence world. But
there's that. There's a different kind of skiff. Yeah.
You're going to have to tell a lot of the people who have been nominated for that, I think, that word later. But
well, and we also have
Cybervan.
The Cybervan. It could be a skiff of a skiff.
Yeah.
This could be a skiff skiff. But those have like a great potential to be a living room, poker room, workout room, and distance could be covered. Founders know that every missed call is a missed opportunity. Customers don't want to wait. They will call someone else if you don't pick up. But if you use OpenPhone, you're never going to miss another customer call. And guess what? It's super affordable and easy to use. People used to spend tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars putting in a corporate phone system. And now for just $15 a month, OpenPhone will give you a business phone line and complete control of your destiny. Want to know who's answering customer calls and how they were handled? OpenPhone can do incredible things like sync with HubSpot and give you AI-powered call summaries, automated responses to ensure you don't miss a single ring. Well, that's all built into OpenPhone. And if you've got an existing phone number, they will let you port it over at no extra charge. Get 20% off your first 6 months. What an amazing offer. At openphone.com/twist. That's openphone.com/twist for 20% off for 6 months. As we wrap here with you, what's going on with nuclear in the United States? We're seeing customers show up in terms of big tech with big iron saying, we'll pay. And they're becoming customers of these small modular reactors and maybe asking them to turn things on or put data centers next to existing nuclear power plants. Did you think we'd see in our lifetime from the 1978-79 No Nukes concert, shout out to Jackson Brown and Bob Dylan, with the greatest performances of Tangled Up in Blue ever, was at the No Nukes concert. And I was very inspired by that concert as an 8 or 9 year old when it happened. And my whole life, I was like, yeah, no nukes, thumbs up. And now we realize, well, that was a huge mistake that celebrities got behind. And now people are starting to say, hey, maybe I'll buy a small modular reactor. I'll put a deposit down. Google, Microsoft, everybody seems to be getting in on this. Is it going to happen? We'll be sitting here 10, 20 years from now, and there'll be many more nuclear reactors in the United States. You heard Sachs probably on All In say, not in my backyard. I don't want to be anywhere near that.
Well, I actually heard Sachs people. Also. Yeah, I think Sachs also said he's afraid to fly. That's what I really took away from that. Those planes in the air are scary, scary.
Actually, it's a true story. I've been on flights with Sachs. He's never been a calm flyer.
Let me say the following. When I was in high school, I worked on the Senate Energy Committee on what we're going to do with nuclear waste. We've done nothing in 40 years. And I would have said 3 or 4 years ago, nuke power, it's insanity. I mean, it just doesn't, we're not going back down that wormhole. But this really begins with data centers. The amount of energy that's being demanded by the hyperscalers, carbon-free, is unfathomable. It is going to be the biggest thing, I think, to hit energy since fracking. It really is unbelievable. And the hyperscalers have said, we need baseload carbon-free power that is reliable. And that's brought them back to nukes for reasons that you've discussed, Bill Gurley, and first discussed. And so, but you want it, modular is better than large because it fits the data center sites. Now, in full disclosure, We have an investment in X Energy, in which Amazon and Dow are involved. So I don't want to be accused of talking my book without disclosing it. But I think what you're really seeing is it's data center driven. They want power, they want it reliably, and they're willing to pay for it, and they're innovative. And that's really the change, Jason. That's a whole other show. But the data center stuff is what's really spurred on the new discussion.
So we will be sitting here in 10 to 20 years, in all likelihood, with new nuclear plants in the United States. And to your point about waste,
it'll be solved. That's not the best answer, probably, but it's certainly one that works. And the amount of waste required is not that big, and it can be controlled. But yes, to answer your question, 20, 30 years from now, I believe we'll see material increase in electricity from nuclear power. As we demand more electricity, the whole world is electrifying. There's just no doubt about it.
Alex, anything left for you before we dismiss Phil and let him get back to work?
I'm going to just point out that Elon Musk recently did a chat, and this was a chat on October 29th, and he said, yes, we are going to need a lot of energy, but he argues, Phil, that, quote, long-term, almost all the energy that we're going to get will come from the sun. And his argument is that if we're ever going to go up the Kardashev scale from, you know, zero to a type one, type two civilization, it's going to be essentially all solar-based. And so I'm also a SMR, a nuclear energy bull, and I'll just say YIMBY to this, not NIMBY. My backyard's good to go. Put a reactor here. I'm fine with it. But is this a temporary fix until we sort out solar generation and storage on a mass scale? Essentially, are SMRs a band-aid to get to our solar future?
Well, I mean, I don't know what time frame Elon's talking about. He could be talking about a century. So, I mean, I don't think of band-aids over a 20 or 30-year period. I think we're talking about 20 or 30 years more. So he's a visionary. I'm not a visionary. I don't think that we're going to be an all solar world, over the next 50 or 60 years. That seems a bridge too far for me. But look, the man is not to be trifled with when it comes to seeing the future.
All right. So a couple generations more nuclear power, and then perhaps a solar future. Jason, either way you slice that, it's green energy that's low carbon. So I think either way, I'm happy.
I'll give you one prediction. I don't believe that there's ever been a data center built of scale in the United States that's not connected to the grid. They all connect to the grid.
Hmm.
I think Musk will do one that's not. That's my prediction.
You believe he can build a hyperscaler, a massive data center for AI that is not plugged into the grid? Wow, that is bold.
Let me tell you, I don't know if he can, but I'll tell you, if anyone can, he will. And I suspect he must be thinking, given everything he cares about, carbon-free, anti-government, scale, speed, try and control as much as he can on the private side. If anyone's going to do it, it's going to be him. And I suspect will be of interest to him.
Well, if you think about it, let's think out loud about this incredibly bold prediction. If you had a battery factory, and and let's say your battery factory happened to be in a very sunny state, like, I don't know, Nevada. And let's say you had a couple of companies that had a big need for electricity for AI, XAI, Twitter/X, and of course, Tesla. Well, if you have the batteries coming out the back of the factory and you just sell one and keep one, and then you're making the solar panels here. Is he making the solar panels here? I wonder. Or you're importing.
I think he's going to need natural gas, Jason, which he might not. But he's used natural gas in his plants in California. He can't get away from it.
Some natural gas going. But I mean, literally the factory's there and the batteries are coming out the back, the batteries would never see the sun. They would literally just go to their eventual resting point at the end of the conveyor belt. That's brilliant.
Right. So if you think about nat gas is priced by location. And in some places, it's very, very cheap because no one uses it there. So if you were to build a data center where there was abundant nat gas, and if you were someone like Musk who was willing to take some technology risk and wrap it, it could be pretty interesting. Now, that's really kooky talk, but it's pretty interesting.
Well, and if you look at nat gas, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's some burn off from when you're like
flaring is what you think of.
And I don't know how much of that there is, but some amount of that could go into batteries. And he's doing some really incredible stuff with battery storage in Australia. So this becomes like really interesting. If people are buying the natural gas, great. But if they're not buying it, it can keep flowing and flow into the batteries. And then you smooth out the curve. Really interesting. The world's going to be amazing if energy gets close to free. I mean, this will change geopolitics forever. Yeah.
But look, it's already negative in certain things. And as you know, that's where a lot of people think about Bitcoin mining and how to think about that. So, you know, just the one way to think about it, we said this at, you know, the summit, everyone in the world thinks of data center size. It's not by square footage or how much they cost. It's completely done by how much power they use. And so the world of tech and energy are now really fully integrated, and every hyperscaler is focused on energy.
Yeah. Amazing. And, you know, what could happen also with desalinization of water. And then, you know, that's an energy problem from what I understand. And some countries, Israel, other, you know, islands, they're all desal and they have to burn oil to do it. Now you'd be able to do that with batteries, solar, renewables, nuclear. And if water becomes free,
or solar. I think Israel uses that gas, by the way. But but that's why the fusion, obviously the next step is fusion, right? Yeah, right. That would be even another bridge.
Yeah. So, well, anyway,
do we need fusion? I mean, the thing is, I was very optimistic that we're going to get to more commercially viable net positive fusion reactions in the next, you know, 10, 15 years. But after just looking at the growth of solar power generation, both here and abroad, improvements in battery technology, and even though in SMRs, I wonder if we need fusion to complete a green energy revolution at all.
For me, that's too hard. You know, I'm very confident tech wins. But for me to say which tech shouldn't win and that I know more than like the guys at Commonwealth Fusion versus, you know, so-and-so new thing, that's not something that I've thought as much about. I think right now there are a lot of really smart people running at really interesting problems, and there's going to be a lot of success. It's going to make us happy.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Phil, I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge here. Where can people learn more about your firm? I've got to give you a plug. I don't know that you need a plug.
No plug. At your next summit. That's good enough for me.
We'll see you at the next summit. All right. Thanks, thank guys. You to my guy. Take care. Well, that was amazing, huh, Alex? It's just really great to have an expert on and, you know, kind of fill in our gaps, right? And which there are many.
Well, I mean, I just want to point out that Phil dialed in from a fancy airport lounge. And so if his audio quality, if you're on audio, wasn't as up to our usual par, that's because we had him on like an iPad in an airport, because that's how dedicated Phil is to coming on the show. Jason, one last thing about this solar energy generation. We found some data from Statista that shows that in 2023, the share of global generation from solar was over 5.5%. And, you know, 10 years ago, it was 0.8%. Now, a lot of work to do, but I'm just very encouraged by this. And my point about the fusion thing wasn't to dismiss or diss fusion startups. I think they're awesome. But I just like that we don't have to solve commercially viable fusion generation in the near term to help the planet and get more power, because we need more power and greener power. So,
I mean, one of the things I always like to focus on, you know, I really don't like politics, pretty icky, right? And I don't like to spend time with politicians. There's been some reports that I'm vying for a position in the administration. I can assure you those are false.
Asked you that on the show like two days ago. And I was like,
I didn't realize that multiple newspapers have said that I'm vying for a position in the administration. I'm not. I'm supportive. And I hope them for the best. And if they did ask for help, I would help on the margins in an advisory capacity, I guess, as an American. If I was called to help in some way, I would. But I like to hang out with technologists, I'll be honest. And the reason I like to hang out with technologists is every time I see a big problem, and, you know, I get to play my small part by talking about it here with you and maybe highlighting some of the innovations and maybe placing a bet on some of them, that feels like a very... a high use of my time, a really good use of my time. And I am just astounded that a lot of the things we have been told are intractable, I guess is a good word.
Yes.
Are not at all intractable. And so if we are sitting here and we were told our entire adult lives, and as long as I can remember from the oil crisis, which I remember in 1976 or 1977, I remember my dad having to go get gasoline And it was based on if your license plate ended in an even or odd number, I believe. Right. And I was like, oh my God, this is like dystopian. We're not going to be able to travel in the car. And it wasn't that bad. You just couldn't get gas, you know, 3 days a week, and you get the gas the other 4 days or whatever it happened to be. Long story short, during the gas shortage and some things, you know, and there's no nuke stuff, technology reigns supreme, and entrepreneurship and capitalism. I gave him a little speech yesterday. Just going to give it again. Any problem that you think is intractable, get off your ass, get a team together, and take a swing at the bat, and we'll give you the first 100K. And there's a bunch of people out there who'll give you the next 500K, and then there's people who are designed to give you 1 to 3 million, and then there's people who are designed to give you 5 to 50, so on and so forth. Capitalism and entrepreneurship and democracy are the messiest, most effective operating system and stack in the world.
Oh, hard to agree.
And let's appreciate it.
Yeah, and I just want to give a shout out to a company we talked to a couple weeks back, which is ExoWatt. They're doing storage of solar power using solar lenses, not solar panels, and storing this in the form of industrial heat, which they can then use a Stirling engine to power industrial facilities. Just one example of founders that are building domestically awesome ways to collect and then disperse energy. So I'm actually very optimistic about power generation in the next 10 years, like, because SMRs are awesome. Fusion's making progress. This is blowing up. And there's so many cool ways people are approaching storing energy, not just batteries. There's compressed air storage. There's all sorts of awesome things. So frankly, I really do think that we're going to see, as Phil said, essentially free electricity, I think, by the time my kids go to college.
We're going into the golden age. I've always said it's going to be the roaring 20s, and we're soaking in it. Put aside all the strife around, you know, woke ideology, identity politics, MAGA, you know, all these other culture wars, all of that pales into comparison to the power of a small team to build a technology product or service and change the world. All of this is, like, for me, wasted energy. If all the people complaining about this stuff incessantly and arguing and fighting just built a couple of startups, we would solve the issues we have around education, incarceration, housing. All this stuff is so solvable. And almost all wars are fought over resources.
Yes.
On the margins, you get some religious ones here or there. Those are a little kooky. And hopefully they're in there, you know, the end, as religions move from reading 2,000-year-old books literally to maybe interpreting them. And here we are.
That's so many American Christianity comments that I'm not going to make, given the church that I was raised in.
Founders, if you want to build beautiful software products, you need a beautiful development platform. But the problem is, most issue trackers, they just aren't helpful, and they feel like a chore to use. Linear is different. It's developer first, incredibly fast, beautifully designed, and it's purpose-built for how modern product teams work. With Linear, you can streamline bug reporting and task tracking, plan and spec new features, and manage your long-term product roadmap. That's why Linear is the tool of choice for tech companies of all sizes. Half of YC companies build with Linear. That should tell you something. And it powers Cash App, Scale AI, and Vercel. So here's a call to action. See for yourself why product teams love Linear. Visit linear.app/twist, linear.app/twist, to try Linear for free with your team and get 25% off your first year. That's linear.app/twist.
Jason, before we move on from the green energy thing, there was some late breaking news before we jumped on, which is that the latest reporting indicates that the Trump administration intends to kill off the $7,500
story. Yeah,
I think also Reuters wrote about it, and I'm a little bit disappointed by this, because it felt to me like a pretty effective place to put some of our national capital to encourage a shift towards EVs. So I think, just personally, philosophically, this doesn't track with my view of where we should be going. But there was an interesting tweet from Spencer Hakimian from Tolu Capital Management, and he thinks that you can't repeal this because it won't pass the House, given how many companies that have EV factories in the South. And so I think we're going to see a very interesting political test of a Trump administration objective, and something that might be a little bit harder to pass through the House than you might have expected. I'm just kind of curious where this goes and who wins in the near term.
Okay. This is a multifaceted story, I believe. I don't have any inside information, lest anybody think I talked to the administration or to any particular friends of mine. Very simple. You can buy a used EV right now for $10,000 to $25,000. My Model X I've had forever, which has relatively low miles on it, like maybe 50 or 60,000 miles, is worth like $15,000 to $20,000 for a Model X. It's crazy how many of these EVs are available at such low prices. And the battery packs, everybody was like, oh, battery pack after 10 years is done. It's like quite the opposite. They seem to be like maybe 10% degradation, which means they're perfect for a city car or even like a suburban car. No problem as a suburban car. Maybe if you had to drive, I would say 3-4 hours a day. Yeah, you're going to probably want to get a newer one with a 300-mile battery pack as opposed to the older ones, which had typically 150 to 250-mile battery packs. So I do think maybe these are unnecessary now. I don't mind spending a little bit of money, of taxpayer money, to do this, because it will take literally, it'll give back, I think, years of life to people in certain cities where we used to have smog problems. And it sounds crazy, but there was a study done out of Berkeley. I don't have it in front of me here, but this study showed that in Shanghai and cities in China where there were smog problems, it was the equivalent of people smoking a pack of cigarettes a day or two packs of cigarettes a day, depending on which city you were in. This is a 10-year-old study. I talked about it here on the show. As those cities have gotten cleaner and they are really pushing EVs there, that means everybody gets back like years of their life. And, you know, these are cities with 20, 30 million people in it. So if 30 million people get back 5 years, it's 150 million years of human existence, which is just beautiful to survive that. So, but if you look at what he said with the cyber taxi, that they can make those for $30,000, maybe it gets to 20. If there was a $20,000, $30,000 EV right now, they would not be able to keep them in stock. I believe the reason Tesla stock is, you know, so high is because they will, and I have no inside information, always give that disclaimer. I'm just guessing that cyber taxi, there's going to be a hatchback, like a two-door version of that with the steering wheel. Just a guess. Because if that existed, I would have ordered two on the first day. I literally would have ordered two and had those for, you know, me to drive and the bigger cars for when I'm with the kids, and just take a smaller car that's zippy with two seats in it. Why not? I would love to have like a two-seat $30,000 car to just zip around in. Long way of saying, when the free market solves a problem, I think it's a good idea that we step back. There are lots of dynamics that we're going to see over and over again. You pointed it out. This dovetails with Doge. So both of these impact Elon and his role. I think this is brilliant because it gives Elon the high ground in terms of, well, if I helped, you know, Trump with his administration and I'm helping cut costs, and I was the first one who said, you know what? I wouldn't be surprised if Elon tweets like, yeah, I'm in favor of it. Take the subsidies away from everybody. The government doesn't need to pay for them anymore. If he said that, it might give a hit to Tesla stock. I'm unsure how much of what they do, you know, the subsidies drive at this point. But it would be the high ground. And the same thing with rural internet. I said this publicly. Why are we paying for rural internet when Starlink exists? And there's five competitors to Starlink that are in some process of getting their satellites out. In fact, SpaceX is putting them up for them. So why on earth would we get involved in rural broadband and run fiber lines when those same people are ordering Starlinks today while they wait for the government to run a $20,000 fiber line? This is why Doge is so brilliant. If they get it done, these are the kind of low-hanging fruit. Just cancel these. And you pointed it out perfectly. Will politicians, under the direction of Trump, Vivek, Elon, start giving back money and not taking the money that they fought really hard for their constituents to, you know, bring jobs to their region, to bring economic value? Will they give that money back and let the taxpayers not have to pay as much tax? That's really fundamentally what we're going to be talking about here. And it is a tragedy of the commons because everybody has to agree, smaller government, less spending. And you can't have like Alabama say to Colorado, yeah, you give up X, Y, and Z. We're not giving it up. We need it more than you. And that's the standoff that we're going to have over the next couple of years. It's going to be messy as hell.
It's going to be very, very messy as hell. But I just do think, though, that there are sometimes we use money in a way that does help accelerate change that can be very positive. And I'm worried of the following possible chain reaction. Tax credit goes away. Every non-Tesla major American car company pulls back from electric. And then the electrification of the American car fleet gets set back 10 or 15 years. And we have more pollution and more dependence on the variability of oil prices, which we are the biggest producer in the world now. Hell yeah. But is that the future we want to be leaning into, or more into electric and solar and green and so forth? And I think you and I share a perspective on the fate of the planet.
Let me ask you a question on that.
Yeah.
Do you believe it should be a state's issue or a federal issue?
The tax credits for EVs.
And the standards for them. Because we do have in California. Like, I wonder sometimes if the federal government, you know, is too big, too involved, and that states could mitigate this. And if in Texas, they don't have a tax, an additional tax, and additional rules on how clean gasoline is, people can live in Texas and make their decision. If you want to pay an extra dollar per gallon of tax in California and have cleaner air, and have different standards for how many miles per gallon it has to be, would that not be better? And then car companies could say, you know what? Screw it. We're not going to make this model of car. If you want to have a Suburban, it's not available in California, but it's available in these other states. California gave us some standards we didn't want to hit, but you can buy it in these other states. And then people be like, you know what? It's too frustrating to live in California. California's got to react to it. And we keep the 50 states. Dare I say, this parallels the abortion debate. And then it parallels the gambling, online gambling debate, and it parallels the debate around cannabis. And it seems like the way to make progress sometimes is to let the states fight it out and let them come to their own conclusions on a very local basis. I don't know, your thoughts?
Well, I think letting the states lead is often a good way to go about things. I mean, why has Texas always had outsized influence on American education via textbooks? Well, they have a unified system. They buy a lot of textbooks. And so Texas's educational standards have long had outsized influence on the rest of the nation. Yeah, it's if you're into keeping religion out of schools, it's one of your things you keep tabs on. But California has even more population than Texas does. I think California's 39 million. Texas is roughly 30 million. These are the two largest states by population, by the way. Florida's number three, then New York. But we're always going to have large states wanting to push their own perspectives and agendas. So ERCOT in Texas, Texas independence, woo, you know, we can do it our own. And then California, the sixth largest economy in the world, has its own standards. I think it would be a mistake for the federal government to say to individual states, you can't have stricter standards. But I think it would be difficult if we could say there's a federal standard and you could have a looser one at the state level, because then you have a tension between who's in charge. So I think California should be allowed to have its own rules and should be allowed to throw its weight around, because that is one of the laboratories of democracy. It's one of the states. So I'm hoping, and getting back into politics, I'm hoping that the Trump administration doesn't preclude California's ability to set regulations about cars like we're hearing they might, because that would set us back even further. So I don't know. I want self-driving electric cars and big batteries. That's what I want. Here is it gets the, me there faster.
By the way, good job, producer John. Berkeley Earth 2015 article, air pollution location equivalent in cigarettes per day. In U.S., the average person, because of pollution, in this 2015 article was smoking 0.4 cigarettes a day. In Shenyang, the worst ever recorded, it was the equivalent of smoking, you want to guess, or are you looking at it?
I saw it.
Oh, 63 cigarettes a day. That's three packs of cigarettes. Beijing averaged 4. On a bad day, 25.
Oh,
so
man.
You just think about that. You know, you're and the tragedy of this is you know, tell your kids not to smoke cigarettes, and then you live in Shanghai or Beijing or wherever, and or one of these other, you know, industrial cities, and they're your kids, babies are smoking 60 packs of cigarettes a day. That's not good.
So, Jason, you've smoked cigarettes before, I presume,
I like a cigar. Okay. You know, to this day, I'll still smoke a little cigar once in a while.
Yeah. I used to smoke cigarettes before I gave that up.
You did?
Yeah. I used to drink a lot. And the two kind of go hand in hand.
Yes, they
do. Let me tell you, if you smoke a pack of cigarettes, which is 20, you feel it the next day. You don't feel
it. Do you really?
I always did. Like, a pack a day is a lot of cigarettes. That's
how many cigarettes is not discernible. You know, you smoke two a day and you wouldn't feel it the next day.
Because for me, it was always paired with alcohol. I can't disassociate the two. Yeah. But my point is, a pack a day is a lot. Two packs a day is a lot. 60 cigarettes a day. I mean, that's like you're being punished hour.
By your dad, and he puts you in the closet because he caught you, and he says, "Okay, you smoke these three packs, and then you feel so nauseous you never go near him again." That happened to me when I did three shots of gin when I was like 13 or 14 years old, and man, maybe it was like five shots, and I just never. I see that Tanqueray bottle, that green bottle. I literally will feel like I'm about to pass out. There's some other things on the docket I wanted to get to. I think this Poly Market story is super important because, I hate to, everything seems to go back to politics this day, but, these days, but Poly Market has captured people's imagination. You know where I stand. Adults should be able to do what they want with their money, mm-hmm. and we should allow accredited, non-accredited people to become accredited through a simple test.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's so many ways to skin the cats. I don't know why. You can go to Vegas or you can do online poker in, I don't know, 3 out of 5 states, but you can't place a bet on the election. I mean, it seems kind of stupid to me, but there seems to have been an FBI raid on the CEO. This is all confirmed now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe take us to the story. The FBI raided the CEO of Poly Market's home, kicked down the door at 6 a.m. and took his devices, I heard. I don't know if this is all true, but this seems pretty dramatic. And it happened 5 days after the election.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Poly Market was the number one of the top searches on the internet. And they obviously predicted absolutely correctly, you know, in those final couple of weeks, months, the election results. I mean, down to the state, it seems they got right in some cases. So,
yeah,
so the story.
Yeah. Okay, so the FBI carried out a search of Shane Copeland's house. He lives in New York City. Now, keep in mind, he is the CEO of Poly Market. Poly Market is putatively not open to U.S. residents, and there's been quite a lot of back and forth between regulatory bodies in the American government and so-called prediction markets. So, Jason, that's Poly Market, and also Kalshi, which critically has been open to people in the United States. So, there's a lot of back history here, Jason, and I don't know how much of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission or CFTC we want to get in here, but the gist, as far as I can tell, is that looking broadly at prediction markets and the US government, the CFTC felt that these types of wagers on what are called, I think, event-based binary options, essentially you make a bet, does something happen, does something not happen, should not be allowed to target elections, because there's concern that if you introduce gambling on, or investing, if you wish, on elections, it can increase the chance of meddling. And this is also, by the way, something that comes up in sports a lot. It's why athletes aren't allowed to bet on their own games, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Google Shohei Ohtani, baseball, gambling, if you want more on that. But the CFTC got its butt kicked repeatedly in federal, in different courts. And so by the end, you could, on Kalshi, I believe, bet on the election. Now, Poly Market, different. And I think this is going to hinge probably, Jason, on if Poly Market did enough to prevent U.S. citizens from using its service. Now, I know you're a poker player, and I know you've played online. I'm sure you remember Black Friday and how we all had to go use VPNs for a while. Do you think that's the same issue here with Poly Market?
I suspect that's what's happening. The regulatory bodies should not get to determine how Americans spend their money, except maybe on the margins on, you know, extremely dangerous things. But I don't see the harm in placing a bet on political candidates. You can do it in Vegas. You could do it outside the country. So it's going to happen no matter what you do. And maybe a little transparency, maybe upper bounds or limits on them. So if you bet over $100,000, you have to have your name associated with it, or there could be other rules. Because perhaps at the edge of the margin, I don't know, some incredibly wealthy person could manipulate the market if it didn't have enough liquidity to give a perception that a certain candidate was running. Let's take it out of the presidential politics. Let's pick a smaller one, like the mayor race or something. And so a rich person runs for mayor. They get 10 rich friends to place bets on these markets in a very coordinated way. They paint the tape. You can look that up. It's a way of making or wash trades, trades that make it look like there's more volume than there is. This is something that happened in crypto a whole bunch. People thought, oh my God, I'm going to buy this NFT. It's traded 50 times in the last 2 months. So I'll just be the 51st trade and then I'll flip it. And it turns out the other 50 trades were the same two or three people with 10 fake accounts each trading it. And then you're the what's called the bag holder. Wash trading, painting the tape. These things exist. There's regulations around them for a reason. The same regulations could apply to prediction markets. And just like you're not allowed as an NBA player or an owner, I believe, or a referee to gamble, because we saw what happened with the Tim Donaghy NBA scandal. I think he was telling mobsters, I believe, or gamblers, who was going to be the umpires, who were going to be the officials at a basketball game. And based on who was officiating a game, you could get a bet in early because you knew their patterns. This is like really, really, you know, interesting, sharp, because if you get a 2-4% advantage and you're placing a lot of bets over time, it could be a tremendous advantage. Putting all this aside, I suspect what happened here, because it's now conspiracy theory corner time, everybody's paralleling this to the Hunter Biden laptop case, in which the FBI was able to get that story banned, or, you know, the link to the story in the New York Post banned. And they were able to do that because they said, hey, this is Russian interference. That seems pretty logical, because Trump himself did ask Russia to hack Hillary's thing, and the Russians were doing all kinds of shenanigans. They always do shenanigans. They're like, it's kind of what they do, right? The place is run by a KGB agent. Doesn't mean that Trump is a Manchurian candidate, but you could believe Trump is not a Manchurian candidate, and there's no P tape, and then on the other side, believe the Russians do interfere, and of course they do. So the FBI's got egg on its face, as do all the people who signed off on saying, hey, this thing is not real. It turned out to be real. They shouldn't have banned it. Public should have been able to figure it out. But that was a really difficult decision to make, I think, a couple of weeks before an election, in fairness. But it does seem like there was some conspiracy or cover-up there. Now everybody's saying this is a conspiracy or cover-up. So how do we process that? Because I'm starting to think about it in game theory. And I'll give you my position on it after you queue it up. But there's a lot of conspiracy corner going on here. I don't have my tinfoil hat. I've got to keep one here. But if I put my Alex Jones tinfoil hat on.
Oh, the globalist conspiracy, poly market, and put the sharp money on Peter Thiel.
And I mean, like, where are we supposed to even go with this, right? Like, is this revenge because Trump won? I don't understand. I don't think that they've got the cause and the correlation. I think they may know the correlation, but not the causation here. Anyway, tell me what's going on with the conspiracy corner.
The reason why politics is inescapable in this case is that Polymarket is backed by Founders Fund. Founders Fund, of course, is associated with Peter Thiel. And there's a lot of money from the Peter Thiel world that went into backing a Trump victory. So if you are Shane Copeland and you just got raided by the FBI and they just took your devices and you want to rally people to your side, what do? You get on X and you make a tweet that says, and I quote here, "It's discouraging that the current administration would seek a last-ditch effort to go after companies they deem to be associated with political opponents." To me, this is the epitome of what is usually dismissively called virtue signaling, and I don't think it's what's going on. So people talk a lot about government and how they use the law. My favorite example of this recently is that when Hunter Biden was in trouble with the law, Joe Biden was like, well, it'll play itself out and we'll see what happens, and let that process go, letting his son get essentially pilloried in the press and in court and look terrible. And he kept telling him, I love you, but we'll see this through. That's the guy we're talking about. Not the type of guy who waits until after an election to go after a thing. The timing just doesn't make sense to me here. So Shane, 10 points for rallying, you know, your team to your side. Good job grabbing the news cycle. I just don't think that it's true.
I believe that many conspiracy theories come true, but the majority don't. Right. So let me just put out my general concept on conspiracy theories. Sometimes yesterday's conspiracy theory is tomorrow's Pulitzer. We saw that with the Catholic Church. I talk about that example all the time. you know, people thought it was a conspiracy theory that that was the world's largest pedophilia ring. Turned out to be true. So let's put it aside. And congratulations to the team at the Boston Globe. Incredible research and investigative journalism for decades to uncover this incredibly just abhorrent, you know, a cover-up that occurred in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Put all that aside. In this case, I'm trying to figure out if you were going to do this,
mm-hmm.
and you're the FBI, and it's a conspiracy theory, okay, what are you trying to accomplish? If you went after them 6 months before the election, and you did it, that would mean you believed that they had an impact on the election, and that election impact, if they were Democrats in the FBI who were doing this, would hurt their team, and they would stop it before it could hurt their team. But there would also, people have to also recognize that the overwhelming majority of law enforcement is conservative, like 60 or 70% like are conservatives.
Jason, just to add to that, the divide, the classic divide, is that the FBI is more conservative and the CIA is more liberal, just to give everyone some background.
I wasn't aware of that, but I just know from being in a family of law enforcement and being around it my whole life, pretty conservative. Like
pretty conservative.
Very conservative. Like the only time it wasn't conservative where maybe in like the Northeast, you would have like a union and the Democrats would fight harder for getting a union, you know, pay increases, and the Republicans want smaller government. This is historical. This no longer sure. applies. It seems the government, you know, would be, you know, save the government money. It was the classical, you know, not give in to the unions and their demands. Putting all that aside, on a game theory,
mm-hmm.
okay, you want to do what now? Punish them? Stop them? Because the election results are done. Or is there like a, is there some greater conspiracy here where we don't know, but maybe they have evidence that there was a coordinated effort to manipulate the market, and they want that to be on record between now and the new year when Trump takes over the Justice Department. So let's say there was some coordinated attack, and I don't know, Shane became aware of it or something, or there was market manipulation. But I don't think the market manipulation would have any impact on the election. So no. I don't think the prediction markets influence people's voting. I don't. I mean, it's such a niche thing that like, am I going to not vote for Kamala because I see the prediction market is 60 cents to 40 cents? I don't think so. If I'm a Democrat, I'm going to vote for her. If I'm a Republican, I'm going to vote for Trump. Like it's already baked in. And then the moderates in the middle who are like quirky people like me, I don't know where you stand on that, but you know, the people who are double haters, is Polymarket's having no impact on me. My best friends were lobbying me to come out for Trump publicly, and I didn't do it. That would have a much bigger influence on me as my high profile friends asking me to support Trump and me taking all these arrows because I refuse to. So I just can't figure out the logic of this case, which is another way of saying it's probably true that people cheated and pretended they were outside the country and placed bets. I don't think that's Polymarket's responsibility. I'll be totally honest. If people cheat and they get fake ID and they go to a bar and the bar checked your ID or they check ID on a regular basis and you order a drink, that's on you. That's on the person who came through. And so I don't know. I think that this, to me, it smells fishy, but we don't have complete information. Let's wait for complete information. I bet you this is like a ticky-tacky.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is most likely a ticky-tacky. There were some cases of people using a VPN and somebody said, hey, Shane, we caught some people. And he probably said, okay, yeah, ban their accounts or let's refer it to the compliance department, which is what I would do as CEO. So this seems very strange to me. I like the idea of waiting. Over speculating, yes. Even though I just speculated for 10 minutes with you.
I know. You and I can't help ourselves. Two things to add to that really quick. One is main character syndrome. The prediction markets inside of, I would say, right-leaning venture circles have been anointed with the mantle of Oracle. And they are now treated as essentially reality writ chart. Cool. I think they're neat. I track them. I use them as one data point in a mix. But hey, A lot of people really do think that they are the future. So if you are that person, especially if you're the center of the storm, the CEO of the company itself, probably you feel like you're a nail and everything else is a hammer. I get that. The other thing that I'm going to say is the CFTC had a settlement with Polymarket. I think this was back in 2022, Jason. I think it was like a, I'm sorry, was it like a $1.4 million settlement? But the point is they've already been on the CFTC's radar. So I
as
think,
has Kalshi, right? And
well, as
the
we discussed,
other one,
yes.
Predict-It. Yeah, I mean, there's been like, oh wait, did you say Polymarket or Predict-It?
Polymarket.
Polymarket, yeah. Because yeah, Predict-It so, also had a judgment against it, I think, and Kalshi obviously had a legal battle to mm-hmm. do all this. So
I want to say one more thing, though, which is that I don't think the regulators here are the devil. I know that's not a popular sentiment in technology mm-hmm. right now, but I think they're trying to enforce the rules as they're currently written. So maybe instead of constantly just, you know, whacking regulators with sticks, we should go to Congress and shake up the actual underlying rules that we're using and then allow for transparency in the prediction markets to allow adults to do whatever they want without the concerns that we have about transparency and wash trading and manipulation and so forth. But no, I don't think most people pay attention to this at all. I don't think it changes votes. And I think this is peak nerdery. And I bet you it comes down to KYC, which is pretty frequent in the world of fintech.
That is probably correct. By the way, I know Shane. I've met him. Mm-hmm. He was on the live stream. If you're running a big enterprise like this and it's going really well, you don't need to break the rules. Like, there's no upside in him breaking the rules. So I would be incredibly, incredibly shocked and disappointed, frankly, if there was anything that he did that was not by the books. When you run a prediction market, I know this because, you know, I was an investor in Uber, which was known to, you know, have some disputes with regulators from time to time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And you know what you do? You have a lot of lawyers. You're buttoned up. You're very thoughtful about these things. Even though from the outside it may look chaotic, you're very strategic. Like, you have a lot of people discussing every one of these issues and doing the right thing. And yes, maybe saying we disagree with how ride sharing works in San Francisco, or how you interpret it, or how the taxi lobby interprets it in New York, and how our attorneys and we interpret it, and we are willing to fight that fight. Long story short, let's wait for the facts to come out, folks. Let's not jump to some crazy conclusions here. Either way, I think it's going to be a ticky-tacky minor thing that's going on here. And sometimes the FBI, you know, goes on little adventures because they get some tips or something like that, and it all turns out to be like either like a ticky-tacky fine, you know, here's your $100,000, $1 million fine, you could have done a better job here and here.
Yeah.
And that's just part of business. So I'm guessing that's what this is going to be. Some ticky-tacky little thing where somebody signed up. Now, there should be some thoughtfulness around the whales in the system when we started this. Any whales in the system, the percentage of whales, the protocols you're using, I know they use a specific protocol, the UMA protocol here, the transparency, all that stuff should be above board. And people should know what's going on in these marketplaces, because I do think any system that could be abused will be abused. Market manipulation would probably be not foreign actors, more likely foreign actors looking to make money. So a lot of times when foreign actors get involved in this, what people forget is sometimes they're from regions where the foreign actors are like the mafia in that country, and they like money.
Yes.
And a lot of the hacking that occurs is more about money than the nation state. And the nation state allows these hacking groups to use hacking to make money. Mm-hmm. And then they get to use them also for other nefarious things, like hacking into a political candidate's, you know, Gmail, which they did, I think, for J.D. Vance and Trump this time around. And none of the press would print those hacks. Am I correct? And that's how that one wound up?
Ken, I can't pronounce his last name. Knippelstein, something like that, did post it, and then ironically got in some trouble with social media bosses. But I think we now have kind of decided that nation state based hacking materials probably shouldn't be used. I have various conflicting views about that, because on one hand, you know, availability of information, on the other hand, rewarding foreign actors, it's dicey. But I do think we're going to learn a lot more here. And just to wrap this up, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, as of the time we compiled our notes about an hour ago, had not commented. So more to come here. We will be tracking the story. We will talk about it more. And if this is political meddling into Polymarket, we'll call it out as such. But I agree with Jason. I think this is going to be something much more ticky-tacky and regulatory.
We're going to talk about it on All In tomorrow. I saw it's on the dock tomorrow. So if you want to hear the besties as well, I'm going to have this conversation all over again tomorrow.
All right, Jason, just to wrap up this week, I want to end with kind of a good old-fashioned startup topic, because this is This Week in Startups, and you and I both read through the latest Y Combinator request for startups. They put this out under the banner of it's the golden age for building, and just quoting from them, it seems like we're entering a golden age of building, and we can use it to build things and make the country better. So to me, very much wrapped up in that mantle of American dynamism. And I think it's a medium good list, but a little bit less out there than I expected. How do you want to do this? Do you want me to tell you what I'm thinking, or do you want to take the first stab at this?
Okay. So YC requested startups. And this means, hey, if you don't have an idea, here's some places you might go look around to, you know, markets, basically. And so just to give people some context, Y Combinator is an accelerator.
We have an accelerator
as well. It's called the Launch Accelerator. And sometimes founders come and they have skills and you have a team, but they're not sure exactly where to look for an opportunity. So sometimes this can just creatively get the juices flowing. And so here we are. I think maybe tell me, why don't we do this? You tell me which one you think has got the most potential to build a unicorn startup, and then I'll give you which one I think has the most potential.
Okay, that's really tough because I have several favorites, but I shall pick amongst my children. Mm. And I will put stable coins in the number two spot, and I'll put space companies on top.
Okay. So you got space companies and stable coins. So let's start with space companies. Some of the bullet points here say capitalize on 10x launch cost reduction. Okay. Mm-hmm. We know that that's what SpaceX has enabled. You can get things into space. This is a continuing discussion. There's tons of companies already. Build businesses around satellite applications. Okay. Satellites are already up there. You build the business around the existing infrastructure, create infrastructure for routine space access. Okay. So I think this is an interesting idea. It's kind of in the rearview mirror already. I think founders already know about it. On stablecoins, you have build business-focused stablecoin management platforms. Okay. Platforms that allow you to use stablecoins within a business. In other words, Stripe for stablecoins. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I think if there's going to be a Stripe for stablecoins, Stripe's going to launch it. I think we're going to see Coinbase, Stripe, Robinhood. I don't have inside information on it, but I wouldn't be surprised if every fintech company has their own built-in stablecoin. I know FTX was working on one. Develop easy integration tools for developers, focus on cross-border payments and remittances. Yeah, these are all interesting.
I take it though, you don't seem that stoked about my choices.
I think maybe I'm a little jaded because I'm in this business that I think these are obvious, space and stablecoins. But I think stablecoins is actually probably more interesting than space because I think space everybody's aware of. I haven't really thought about stablecoins 2.0. It's the first time I've ever heard somebody say stablecoins 2.0. Tell me what your thoughts are on stablecoins, since I find that a fascinating place for startups to be built.
Okay, so if you aren't familiar, stablecoins are digital currencies that are pegged to a specific fiat currency. Mostly, Jason, this is the dollar. It's by far the most popular stablecoin peg. And so that means you can buy a token that is worth a dollar, and then you can exchange it back for a dollar. So these companies essentially take in actual currency, hand out digital tokens, and then sit on the reserves, make a lot of money. Circle, we've had Jeremy Allaire on the program, I think, several times. They can build big businesses. Very cool. That's all stablecoins 1.0. I think what happens with stablecoins 2.0 is we begin to see other countries that have their own currencies lose their local primacy. And by that, I mean, once you let people around the world anywhere execute their financial life in dollars, they're going to. It's more stable. It's more accepted. And so I think stablecoins 2.0 are the startups that are out in developing markets that bring broad access to the dollar, or perhaps the euro, pick your currency, to the local market and disrupt entire economies that are currently priced in the local currency. So to me, that's the possibility here. It's getting people a better currency digitally across the internet, And there's going to be a lot of business applications for that, both locally and in terms of connecting them to the broader US economy. So I think it's bullish for us, bullish for smaller consumers, and there's going to be a lot of cool tech there. So I don't know. It feels very democratizing.
Yeah. I mean, it does feel like it will lower fees when you transfer money around. And for places in frontier or emerging markets where you have destabilized currencies, some might argue that's happening to the United States. It seems like an interesting place to look for ideas. So I do like that one as an idea. I think the reason why, you know, the Reddit discussion, the Hacker News discussions were a little bit negative. I noticed some negativity when we looked at some of the threads and people talking about it just broadly, is because some of this is obvious. I think a lot of these are obvious. Let's go through some of the other ones. I do think stablecoin's an interesting one. Government software, AI software to automate government administrative tasks, target large-scale operations like form processing, application reviews. I mean, all this stuff has been going along, build solutions for citizen-facing services, DMV permits and licensing. I think all these are interesting ideas. When I was in the Middle East, government software was a very top-down, high-order bit in Saudi and UAE. In other words, the honorable rulers of those countries had said, they had basically said to anybody working in government, make this more efficient or you're out and you lose your job. I want to see massive efficiency. So it's an obvious one. And maybe with Doge and people saying,
there you go.
You know, that is actually some really good advice, is that maybe selling into these will be less about corruption and more about efficiency and saving dollars. And when you say, I have a way for making renewing licenses 10 times cheaper and twice as secure, maybe Vivek will tweet that. And maybe Elon will say, good idea. And then all of a sudden, you've got the public saying, yeah, I would rather use that system where I take out my phone, I make a video of myself saying, this is Jason Calacanis, I live at this address, I want my driver's license, here's a picture of my license plate, and, you know, I'm okay with you stamping the location of where I am right now and you putting this into a database. And that would be a more secure way of getting a driver's license as opposed to putting a form in. And then you've got a video of me asking for my drive. I'm just spitballing here, folks. Yeah. But that would be harder to fake, right? And me actually making a video of my license plate and having AI process that video where it made thumbnails of my license plate, my VIN number, all that stuff could be in a video. I submit the video, AI process it frame by frame. It knows who I am and it makes me a driver's license and does my registration from a video. Pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. So I like that one a lot. You were going to add?
Well, no, I think it's a great idea, especially because, government is what we do together, but no one's gone to the DMV and left enthusiastic about how it works. So I think if we can apply software and startups to that, that's great. I'm a little skeptical at the pace of federal procurement and how that will impact startup growth curves, but perhaps we are moving on to a new era. But that's a cool one, boring but possibly useful, but again, Jason, to your point, a little bit obvious.
Public safety technology. I like this one. Advanced computer vision, develop privacy, preserving surveillance. I've talked on this show about density.io. One of the things that I got wrong about density when I made that investment was I constantly talked about, like, can't we do this with a camera? And they're like, privacy. People don't want to have a camera over them, you know, at their office. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, fair enough. But I go to offices and there's cameras in the hallway. So can't you count the people there? They're like, you can. It's creepy. Nobody wants it. And then certainly in an Airbnb, nobody wants it. As we've seen, you can get arrested for putting hidden cameras in, and people do. But Waffle, that little people counter, you know, having that, there's a version of that for sound. I got pitched on a company that has a thing that plugs into the wall and it just records the sound level. Now, it's not recording what you're doing. It's just recording decibels. And when you make a product like that and it has on it what it does and what it doesn't do, and it's from a company, you know, you could be like, okay, that's a better way to do it because I can take a picture of that. Airbnb has said, hey, this doesn't record you, but it does do sound levels. If the sound in a space, and if you put it outside, even better, and people know it's there. If you knew the sound level was too high for the neighborhood and you hit 100 decibels and it just sends a text, the decibel reader outside on the porch doesn't record you. It's from this company. The text message is, and the email is from that company. And that company's emailing the host and the guest through the API. You just hit 110 decibels. Can you turn it down? That's going to save a lot of agita or whatever. So I like that. Privacy-enabled stuff, very, very good for
I'm just imagining
America.
Now like a teenager, you know, their parents go away for the weekend and they have a couple of friends over, you know, on the DL, and then they turn the music up a little bit and then it texts their parents and then, you know, there's a lot of stuff I think is cool. Yeah,
I have it in my Teslas now. If the Tesla goes above 90 miles an hour, I have it set to speed limit at like 85 or whatever, plus 10, whatever the speed limit is, and it sends an alert. So only two people driving these cars. If I go too fast, my wife knows. If she goes too fast, I get an alert. It's just a way of like putting some, you know, if you measure it, you can manage it. I don't want anybody dying. I want to keep my family around. So that's like a great way where you can put some rules on yourself to maintain some, you know, lack of speeding in your family. And certainly if when my kids start driving, if they ever do, I don't want them going above the speed limit more than 5-10 miles an hour. So great.
How do you square the Texas ethos, you know, the yeehaw, Lone Star, woo, and you and I wanting to keep our kids alive? Because I feel like there's, you and I at times have this libertarian ethos. Adults should be able to do what they want. You know, it's their money, it's their time. And then we talk about like, you know, limits on cars and sound and such. And so does this all hinge on the age of majority, essentially? Because I don't think my kids are 18.
There's opting into it, right? So if you, in both examples I'm giving, this is me opting into it, right? I have an Airbnb. I decide to stay in an Airbnb that has rules around sound. And I decided my cars to do that. Now, on the public roads, I think you could have a reasonable discussion as to what the speed limit is on public roads, because that's shared. And I'm fine with 85 miles an hour as the upper speed limit. I would like to see cars. If I was going to live in a state with, you know, a really high upper limit, mm-hmm. I think a way to do that, and we have the technology to do that, is if you want to go 100 miles per hour, or, you know, like really fast, it has to be on certain highways, straightaways, et cetera. And it has to be the left lane. And there has to be some left lane rules. And you have to be in a car that hits certain standards, ABS brakes, mm-hmm. you know, certain tires, certain maintenance, and maybe certain insurance. So that would be a way, you know, to take libertarian values and, you know, a shared interest in each other. Maybe you have to pay more in insurance to go that fast. Maybe you have to have an easy pass that you pay a certain amount to go that fast. There could be some creative solutions there that technology enables. So I kind of like
it. I hope so. I'd love to go faster, but let's just run through one or two more of these, Jason. I want to flip it back on you. You asked me which of these do I think are the most interesting, the most compelling. So, I mean, putting it to you, which one of these really, you know, bakes your casserole?
Okay, the one that I was perplexed by, and which then when you're confused by what the person actually means, that means there might be something there. So whoever put 1 million jobs 2.0, create sustainable human-centric job platforms, focus on jobs that AI can't replace, build tools for independent business owners. I kind of like this one. Build tools for independent business owners. By the way, that's Stripe. That's HubSpot. Small business owners, that's FreshBooks, you know, anything that helps somebody be a company of one or two or three, I think is a really smart idea. So Freelance Nation, something we talked about 20 years ago, would happen because of the internet. It's happening today. And then maybe aggregating in the way Uber has. Uber is now as much a platform for transporting stuff as it is a platform for work. And on-demand work. So they have now started doing kind of like an assistant in Uber. This is a Uber product. So anyway, there was like Uber for retail workers. So there was an experiment, I believe, in Florida. Dara talked about it on a recent earnings call. The concept is very simply, you need somebody for $30-$40 an hour to help you with household tasks or business tasks. So you're a retail outlet. You need a cashier. You need somebody to a greeter. You could go into Uber and order one for $40 an hour. Uber takes 25%. They take $10 an hour. You get somebody for $30 an hour. So if you needed somebody for a week at your restaurant to be the maitre d', the greeter. You could just order that from Uber for a shift or two. And those like on-demand work platforms, there's a couple of different ones out there that sort people into buckets. And there's many of them doing retail right now. There's many of them helping with the stuff. We have one, Hey Hire, which helps hire people for jobs in retail. And they're doing very well. They're actually based here in Austin, Texas. So there's a bunch of different platforms there. So I do like that one the best, I think.
Okay. Well, I think that's kind of a contrarian one. I thought you were going to go for the LLMs for chip design, because what they're discussing in that particular bullet point is exciting to me. Lower energy, higher performance, but that's optimistic. I just looked up Fiverr, Jason, F-I-V-E-R-R, public.
Great company,
and
yeah,
they're worth $1 billion. You should just get Darrow to buy them and then just meld that into Uber and then ta-da, huge demand. And therefore Uber is much more a platform for work than just having people bring me burritos and donuts in the morning.
Well, you know, Fiverr is an interesting company because it was worth the market cap. It's worth $28 a share. But during ZIRP, if you look at it, man, it had just boomed. So right now its market cap is $1 billion, but I think its market cap was like $10 billion at one point. There's been a lot of fear that AI and generative AI specifically would kill that company. And if you look, their peak valuation was in 2021. If you look at the five-year chart, and what date was ChatGPT 3.5 launch? ChatGPT 3.5 was launched on November of 2022. And so I think that's where it kind of went into the public consciousness. So I think they got hit pretty hard since 2022, but November of 2022, it was trading, that was trading at $35. So it's actually the same, but I do think, you know, maybe that's the peak ZIRP era, but I do think the LLM started to make people think that freelancers on a marketplace like that would get less work. I think it's going to be the opposite. I don't know what the revenue is. I think what's happening is a place like Fiverr is going to become more valuable because it's going to be you're going to hire somebody using AI and the prices will go down and what they build for you go up. And I think the quality level, I think the number one thing of any gig platform, whether it's Fiverr or there's a couple of other competitors to it for coding and for other things.
Sure.
The issue has always been quality level. Is it going to be really good quality? And I think those people using LLMs, generative AI, co-pilots is going to make the quality go up to the level that more people will use it. That's the only complaint I ever heard about a Fiverr was variable quality. And now I think we're going to have something completely different. We're going to get high quality.
I'm excited by that. Well, I mean, talk to Uber. I mean, maybe they could bring us all together. The thing that I want, if I'm doing like Uber feature requests, is I want to be able to hire a driver for like a 5-hour period.
You can do it. What? Uber by hour exists in a lot of markets. I use it all the time. I don't want to give this hack. Yeah, Uber hourly is 2 hours for a driver. And it is called...
oh my gosh.
Yeah, Uber hourly, it exists.
This has changed my life. Okay.
Yeah. So the reason I do this is, I hate to give this tip, but you know how at some airports, you have to walk a mile to get to the ride sharing area?
Yes.
It turns out Austin is one of those. What I do is I order an Uber for 2 hours. And when I get off my flight, I have the Uber for 2 hours. I'm under an hour from the airport, like maybe a half hour. So I have it for 2 hours. I text the person. I say, hey, listen, I'm coming in. I'm landing at this time. I'd like you to pick me up at departures, not arrivals. Pick me up at departures. I'll sit in the front seat. We can pretend we're friends. And I'm going to stop and pick up dinner on the way home or whatever. And I will stop and I'll do a little shopping at the grocery store. I'll stop by Central Market by the airport. Really beautiful, like nice Whole Foods Plus kind of store. I pick up some stuff for dinner or whatever. I do a little shopping. Or I have dinner with the family, but I have the driver waiting for me, and then I take it home for the rest of the way. But it turns out it's only $20 more for a 2-hour Uber Black than it is for the Uber Black to my house. So I just tell the driver, like, I'm doing this because I want to get picked up at the gate or at the curb, and I might do a stop on the way home to pick something up, but I'm probably going to use it for an hour, not two. So consider the extra hour I paid for the tip. They're like, really? I'm like, yes. I'm not going to use you for the full 2 hours, but it's a great service.
No, I'm going to use the heck out of this because I often want to go to concerts up in Massachusetts and I hate driving, and my wife does not appreciate heavy metal, and we have children at home. So I would love someone just to take me up there, drop me off, let me go to my concert, and then when I'm done, they're already there, take me home. I will pay for all of it.
Okay, I don't know if it exists in your market, but it exists, and they're testing it in other markets. And if this was one of the discussions I had with Dara at one point, which was adjacent markets do really well for them. And like things that are pretty far away, you know, maybe it's a little bit more difficult. So adding hourly is like a really easy add to build the product, and it aligns with the core product, and those things get massive adoption. And so I think that's the journey they're on, is adding like quick adjacencies and getting massive adoption. So convenience stores, which I think was, what was the startup? GoPuff?
GoPuff,
like,
yeah.
Like adding the GoPuff features, I think, which they did for convenience stores. And they have like, I think they've tested like Uber's own version of GoPuff, which is like an Uber outlet store where they have their own stuff. And they can get it to you real quick. But they also did a deal, I think, with 7-Eleven, CVS, and Walgreens. Mm-hmm. And those things are everywhere. So this is why I think Uber's undervalued in some ways, is they, because of their lightweight model, and you have someone like Walgreens, McDonald's, and Starbucks embracing Uber, which people said they never would, and now they have.
Yeah.
And I believe some of the services like GoPuff, well, I think when I was in New York, GoPuff was an option on Uber Eats. So that's kind of interesting. Strange bedfellows, right? Remember we talked about competition the other day?
Yeah, co-opetition.
Co-opetition. Yeah. If you're GoPuff and Uber has many, Uber Eats and DoorDash have many, many more customers than you, and you already have a storefront in Manhattan, why not let them place their order and give, you know, Uber or DoorDash a little bit of percentage and get more customers from your GoPuff store? And for Uber, it's like, okay, we're marketing GoPuff, but who cares? We have CVS in here. We have Walgreens. Why look at GoPuff any differently than we look at our own convenience stores or CVS and 7-Eleven? So,
yeah. And also, cool if product. You're doing it on the Uber app, Uber owns the customer. Hmm. GoPuff doesn't. So I think that makes a lot of sense. I think
wrapping on the YC list, what I wanted to say about the YC list, it's awesome they put it out. It's awesome to inspire people. But you got to come up with an idea that you personally really want to work on for 10 years. So keep that in mind. I don't advise founders take my list of requests or any VCs or any accelerators list and start there. Start with something that matters personally to you. If you can't find something that personally matters to you and your team, I think these lists are great for brainstorming.
Yeah.
So the way we just debated it, maybe you can get your juices flowing by going through this list. So I think these lists do serve that purpose. But it's got to be something like you don't want to create like a space company because you to get into Y Combinator. Create a space company because you really are going to wake up on day 2000 more excited than you are on day 2 or 200. Yes. And if you do something because a VC is interested in it, what you're going to be doing is you're going to be building a product that you're going to wake up one day and not want to go to work to build. So just there's an important caveat there. No dig to YC. It's great they made this list. I've made these kind of lists before too.
Absolutely. I think that they even say, you know, you don't have to be doing anything on this list, but here's some stuff that we're excited about and want to talk about. And I think it's good to have more conversations about it. All right, Jason, we're going to leave it there for today. We've done a lot of live news shows this week. We have more coming next week. He's at Jason over on X. My name is at Alex. I'm over on X as well. And we'll see y'all next week.
Bye-bye.